Welcome to If You Love This Planet. I'm Dr. Helen Caldicott, and in this program we talk about the greatest medical and environmental threats to all life, such as nuclear weapons and nuclear power, global warming, ozone depletion, toxic pollution, deforestation, and many other social and political issues that relate to global well-being. So if you love this planet, keep listening. Hello and welcome to If You Love This Planet. My special guest this week is Dr. Timothy Mousseau, a professor of biological sciences at the University of South Carolina. He currently also serves as the Associate Vice President for Research and the Dean of the Graduate School at University of South Carolina. Dr. Mousseau's past research has focused on the genetic basis of adaptations to changing environmental conditions in wild animal populations, and he has published more than 120 scientific papers on this topic. For the past 12 years, Dr. Mousseau and his colleagues have been studying the ecological impact of the Chernobyl disaster on wild plant and animal populations living in the so-called zone of alienation surrounding the destroyed nuclear power plant. Dr. Mousseau is considered one of the leading world authorities concerning the impacts of low-dose radiation on natural ecosystems. Dr. Timothy Mousseau, welcome to If You Love This Planet.
Thanks, Helen. Pleasure to be here.
Well, this is pretty pertinent today because we've got another absolute catastrophic nuclear disaster going on in Japan. And so the work that you've been doing is terribly relevant. Let's start at the beginning, though. You're a geneticist, a biological scientist, right?
Yes, I started off in ecological genetics is sort of the subdiscipline. Started off looking at the genetic basis of adaptation to changing climates, in fact.
Well, that's kind of evolution, isn't it? Isn't that what... Oh. Darwin discovered the finches changed their beak shape according to the island at the Galapagos on which they resided so that they could gather their food more adeptly?
Absolutely. We were quite interested in looking at how much genetic variation existed in natural populations for these kinds of characters to determine, you know, how quickly they could evolve in response to changes in you know, the climate or changes in food abundance or the type of food. So absolutely, yeah, I started off as an evolutionary ecologist.
Yeah, fascinating. Right, so now, you've been working in Chernobyl, God help you, for 12 years. How did this begin, Tim, this particular research avenue?
Well, you know, it started purely by accident, the way most things do. I had an opportunity to go visit that part of the world, an exchange program funded by a philanthropist here in the U.S., an alumnus of the University of South Carolina, in fact, who was interested in promoting East-West exchange. And so we went and visited, and it looked like had some opportunities to do some good evolutionary ecology, in fact. And the next year, I met up with a very well-known behavioral evolutionary biologist by the name of Anders Mahler, who was at the University of Pierre-Marie Curie in Paris, fittingly enough. And we decided that working in the Chernobyl zone offered some opportunities to study evolutionary processes that could not be studied in any other place. And so we hopped in a plane and went to Chernobyl and started our work together in the spring of 2000, and we've been going back ever since.
All right. Now, what you need to do, Tim, is explain to the audience why the area around Chernobyl is a good place to study evolutionary adaptation, evolutionary biology, evolutionary genetics. What is it about radiation that induces changes in genes, and relate that back, in fact, to evolution of all species on the planet? Can you do that for us in a sort of simple little lecture?
I'll try. The raw material for evolution is genetic variation. Without any genetic variation, there won't be any kind of adaptation. There won't be any kind of change. And so the evolutionary process relies on the presence of some level of genetic variation.
Well, explain what genetic variation is.
Oh, okay. Well, you know, it's variation in the DNA sequences that make up the genes that make up our bodies and make up what behaviors we express and what preferences we might have for mates or food types. It determines how tall we might be, in combination with environmental effects, of course. Most of these kinds of characters, you know, have are the mix of environment and genetics. So in and around the Chernobyl area, where you have different levels of radioactive contaminants in the ground, this leads to more or less increased rates of mutations at the level of DNA, which can change then the availability of genetic variation for evolutionary processes to occur.
Well, now, okay. So just to simplify it, so we've got the human species. We've got tremendous genetic variation. And in fact, I'm a pediatrician, as you probably know, and it always absolutely amazed me that every baby I delivered was so uniquely different, except for identical twins who are genetically the same. And so within our own species, we're so varied, aren't we? Some tall, some short, some smart, some not so smart, different colored skins, the whole thing, right?
Well, that's true. In fact, you know, one of the products of sexual reproduction is you know, recombination of this genetic material, a reshuffling of the genetic deck, as it were, every generation, and this generates a substantial amount of genetic variability. And but most of the variation that codes for important processes, important metabolic processes, tends to have relatively little genetic variation, because as it turns out, any change from that normal genetic composition is usually not beneficial.
Well, now you're talking scientific language. You've got to go back two steps, because this is not a scientific audience on the whole.
I
want you to explain why sexual reproduction, as opposed to species that don't have to have sex to reproduce, like amoebae who just split into half, why sexual reproduction, mixing, you know, the genes of the sperm and the egg, leads to variability. And then explain what you mean by metabolic variability, because people won't understand that. So you've got to be really, you know, we're teaching here.
All right. So as you mentioned, many of the organisms on the planet, especially the simple organisms, but also many plants and some animals, reproduce asexually through either clonal processes or an exact duplication of their genetic material. And so there's no genetic variation inherently produced through that process. They're basically clones of each other. And so what happens in those kinds of species is if there's a change in the environment, there's no genetic variation in the population, or very little, and so they can't respond very quickly. Turns out there's always some level of mutation, but it's just so little, relatively speaking, that the evolutionary response is relatively slow.
Well, and to explain that then, so if you've got a species that are genetically all exactly the same, and there is a change, it gets too hot or it gets too cold, or there are some toxins introduced into the environment or the like, there's no variability. Whereas if you've got a species that has genetic variability, some of them will be more adept to adapt in the new environment than others. Isn't that what you mean?
Exactly. If you have a population with a large amount of genetic variation, it's likely that some of those individuals may be a little bit better at dealing with that change in the environment, and they will thus survive better and have more offspring. And that's basically how evolution occurs. Different genotypes, different individuals with different genetic compositions becoming better at surviving and better at reproducing when the environment changes.
And that's sort of kind of how fish, to be simplistic, fish develop lungs and birds develop wings and...
over long evolutionary time.
Millions and millions and millions of years.
Indeed. Now, some people have suggested that some of these kinds of changes can occur much quicker than that if the climate changes very quickly or, you know, the environment changes in some way very quickly and there's enough genetic variation, then you can see very rapid evolutionary response.
Mm.
But generally speaking, we think of evolution as occurring relatively gradually over ten thousands, millions of years.
Well, now, why would the environment around Chernobyl be interesting to you in terms of genetic variability and adaptation to a new environment? Explain just in simple terms, Tim Rousseau, why that is so.
Okay. Yeah, so, you know, there's Darwin and many evolutionary biologists since his time have spent a lot of time studying how changes in the environment will lead to changes in the population through the process of natural selection. But there's never been any ability to study how changes in mutation rate might influence evolutionary responses. It's been done in the laboratory, but never in nature. We've just assumed that mutation rates are about the same, occur at about the same rate.
Natural mutation rates.
Natural mutations are always popping up. Our bodies have the ability to repair most of those mutations, but every now and then a few of them slip through. But when you have the case like Chernobyl, where you have this increased background radiation level leading to dramatically elevated rates of mutations, our DNA repair systems can't keep up with that, and so you end up increasing the genetic variability of the populations living in this area. Now, it's absolutely true that most of those mutations, probably, maybe all of them, for all we know, are not beneficial. Most of them cause either no effect at all or some slightly or not so slightly negative impact on the organism. There's always the possibility that occasionally a mutation pops up that may have some benefit in the change.
Well, now, Tim, explain how radiation, both external gamma radiation, X-rays, or internal radiation from beta or alpha radiation, how does that cause mutation or changes in the DNA molecule?
Well, it happens in a variety of different ways. The simplest mechanism is when you have a pulse of radiation that hits the chromosome, the DNA, and causes a chemical change in the DNA directly, and that leads to a mutation. If you ingest a piece of radioactive material that goes into your body, gets into your cells, and it emits a particle, an alpha particle or a beta particle that hits a chromosome. It has the ability to potentially break that chromosome into two pieces. Those are two commonly viewed ways of causing mutations, but there are other mechanisms as well. The ionizing radiation can generate oxygen-free radicals, for instance, that will lead to changes in the DNA as well, the chemical composition of the DNA, again, generating these mutations. There's a variety of different mechanisms that may be at play, some that are well-known and others that are not so well-documented. But what is absolutely well known, well established, is that when you increase the level of either external radiation or internal exposure to ingested radionuclides, DNA damage levels go up.
And we really first knew that, didn't we, when a man called Muller irradiated Drosophila fruit flies, I think in 1928, Tim. Would you like to explain that?
You know, that was before my time.
So. Oh, yeah, but you've read about it. Now, I learned it in medical school, so you've got to tell us.
Well, yeah, no, it's not. It's not an area I'm well versed in, so I haven't studied his experiments.
I can tell you what I learned in medical school. You'll know. He took Drosophila fruit fly, which are those little nasty little flies that get into deteriorating fruit, and they reproduce very fast, like, I don't know, 100 generations in a year or something like that. And he irradiated them with X-rays, and we'd only just discovered X-rays at the time. And he found that the radiation, the ionizing radiation that you just talked about, induced a gene for a crooked wing, for instance. And then that gene, when the Drosophila reproduced, was passed on generation to generation. So he saw how radiation causes genetic mutations which can be passed on generation to generation, right?
Indeed.
Mm. And so then we suddenly realized that radiation can be dangerous. Can you just classify what ionizing radiation is, Dr. Tim Musso?
Well, you know, it, when you have a very high energy kind of radiation, like an X-ray or a gamma ray, it can strip off electrons from a molecule and change the charge of that molecule, thus ionizing it, making it charged. And these charged molecules then are chemically very active. And that's basically
a mutation.
What we're referring to. Well, that can lead to mutations, yeah.
Right. Okay, so now just to reclassify Tim, he's a professor of biological sciences at the University of South Carolina. He also serves as the Associate Vice President for Research and the Dean of the Graduate School at the University of South Carolina. He was trained as an evolutionary ecologist at McGill University in Canada. Okay, now you've been working in Chernobyl for 12 years. Tim, what have you been doing?
You know, mostly we have been following populations of animals, mostly birds. We focus most of our effort on a couple of key species of birds, but more recently we branched out into the entire bird community. We started with barn swallows. Barn swallows are a really wonderful study organism. They're very easy to work with. They're easy to find in the wild. They're easy to catch in the wild. Because they have this behavior, this so-called phylopatry, whereby they come back to breed in the same place year after year as long as they're alive, this allows us to actually track individual survival. And because they tend to breed inside buildings, we can usually get to the nest, and we can look at how many eggs and how many offspring are fledged, you know, by these individuals. So it's just a wonderful model species to work with. And the first study we did, we just went around the Chernobyl area and other parts of Ukraine and found populations of these birds and looked at them, counted them and looked at them and put bands on them. And found that in contaminated areas, there were a much greater frequency of visible mutations. Patches of white feathers, in fact, very easy to see and identify. In recent years, we've since found similar sorts of visible mutations in many other species of birds as well. So this is a rather common phenomenon.
White feathers, little patches of white feathers.
These little patches of white feathers. Yeah, it turns out that it seems that the cells responsible for producing pigment in feathers, melanocytes, are rather sensitive to, if there are low antioxidant levels in the blood of these birds, then the melanocytes in parts of the body tend to die, and you end up with patches of white feathers. It turns out that there's a genetic basis or a genetic component to where these cells are most sensitive to the background radiation, and it is passed on from one generation to the next.
And what about, I think you've seen abnormal beaks, deformities in their beaks?
Yeah, so you know, every year we go back and track these populations, and we keep tabs on the numbers of other kinds of abnormalities, as you mentioned, deformed feet, tumors around in their abdomen, tumors around their eyes, tumors on their chin, again, deformed skin, missing digits on their feet, just a wide variety of different kinds of developmental abnormalities, and most of these have not been seen in any other population in the world. And because these are barn swallows we're talking about, you know, they're very well studied by quite a number of people. So there's been a lot of work done with them, and so we know for a fact that these kinds of abnormalities just don't occur with any frequency in other populations where there is no radioactive contaminants. So yeah, we've been keeping track of that. About, I guess, 4 or 5 years ago, we expanded the range of species that we were looking at to include all of the birds living in the forested areas, mostly passerines, songbirds, and again, we documented many different examples of these kinds of abnormalities in these birds that just don't occur anywhere else. And the frequency at which these abnormalities are observed is directly proportional to, you know, the level of background contamination.
Well, so when you say level of background contamination, you mean cesium-137 in the soil or cesium-137 in the seeds that they eat and the insects that they eat? How do you measure that?
Yeah, so we've measured it in a number of ways. A few years ago, we actually got a grant from the CRDF to look at exactly how much of this these radionuclides, as you mentioned, mostly cesium-137 and strontium-90, but also there's a little bit of plutonium and a few other radionuclides in the area. We got a grant to actually look at how much is picked up by these birds and carried around inside their bodies. Mm. We looked at whole body burdens of these radionuclides.
Yeah.
And that was, we found, on average, very closely related to the background radiation levels in the different areas that these birds were living. And so we can...
You mean the amount of radiation they carried around in their bodies was directly related to the background radiation?
Exactly.
Yeah,
so
right.
we could pull out our Geiger counter and put it down on the ground and get a reading on how much radiation was being emitted by the radionuclides of cesium, strontium, and plutonium in the ground, and that was well related to how much the birds were picking up.
Right.
Now that was on average, though. We did also find that individual birds varied tremendously and significantly depending on what they were eating. So birds that were feeding on insects living in the surface soil tended to get more than birds that were, you know, feeding on insects in the air, for instance. So there was some variation depending on, you know, what they were consuming, and also some other kinds of behavioral differences. But on average, there was a good relationship.
And were the older birds more radioactive than the younger birds because they'd been eating more radioactive stuff for a longer period of time?
Well, you know, the problem is that most of the birds in these very contaminated areas don't live very long.
Oh, their lifespans are shortened.
Their lifespans tend to be quite a bit shorter, and so it's actually hard to find older birds to do that kind of comparison on. We did note that the younger birds tended to have a higher proportion of strontium as part of their body burden.
Oh, because they need it for their bones, because strontium is like calcium. Yeah.
Right. They were picking it up as they were growing their new bones. They were picking up the strontium and incorporating them into their bones, while the older birds tended to have a mix of the two.
Are you seeing things like leukemia and bone cancer in the birds from the strontium, or are you not diagnosing what particular tumors and malignancies they develop?
We have just started to go down that path. You know, doing those kinds of assays are a little expensive. We're just beginning to start that kind of work. I just got back from 2 weeks in Chernobyl, and we found, again, three out of 500 birds that had very, very large visible abdominal tumors.
Oh.
And you know, again, that may not sound like a lot, but that's an incredibly high frequency for that kind of growth. And so our plan in the coming years is to start taking biopsies of
these. And making the diagnosis. So now also, Tim Musso, you've also found that a high percentage of the birds have smaller than normal brains. Is that correct?
You know, that we just published those results a few months ago in Plus One. You know, we did this survey of about 550 birds last summer. We took measurements on the brain sizes, the head sizes, and inferred the brain sizes from that for birds living in, you know, high, medium, and lowly contaminated areas for over 40 different species. And we found that for, on average, across the community, the birds living in the contaminated areas had a 5% smaller brain, reflecting impaired neurological development. This has been reported before as a common response to, you know, radioactive contaminants.
Yeah.
It hadn't been reported in birds. But what made this observation particularly interesting was the fact that when we looked at birds in the contaminated areas, we found that the birds with the smaller brains were less likely to survive to the second year. The birds that were older were the ones that had the larger brains. Indicating that there was some cognitive relationship to this smaller brain. So the radiation was affecting the neurological development, which was directly influencing survival, probably as a result of their ability to avoid predators or find food.
Well, now, how can we relate that to everything you've just described, Tim, the genetic abnormalities, the deformities in the birds, the small brains, to the human populations, specifically in Belarus and the Ukraine? I do know from the Chernobyl report that you helped get published by the New York Academy of Sciences that there are homes full of very deformed children. And in fact, I've seen a film called Chernobyl Heart that documents these children, grossly deformed children, in very heavily contaminated areas, number one. Number two, I do also know that I think in Sweden and Norway and Ukraine, there seems to be, amongst children who've been exposed to radioactive material from Chernobyl, a lower than normal IQ level, and also we all are seeing, you know, a high incidence of malignancies amongst people living in these highly contaminated areas. So, can you extrapolate directly from your animal experiments or observations to human populations, Dr. Timothy Musso?
Yeah, you know, it's something we try to avoid, but. But it really, you know, it's just so overwhelming. One of the advantages of working with wild populations of plants and animals is that you don't have to worry about some of the confounding factors that you have in human populations. You know, when these reports, these statistics associated with birth defects in humans and genetic effects in humans and infertility effects and IQ effects, These have all been relatively well known for a while, but But the you know, the traditional interpretation has been that these are the consequence of environmental factors like alcoholism and smoking, as well as immunosuppression resulting from the stress of the disaster, rather than the direct consequences of radiation. But as you know, birds don't drink, they don't smoke, they don't get depressed, as far as I know, at least. Anyway, and so when we start to see parallel patterns of what appear to be responses to the contaminants, you can't help but think that there must be some direct relationship with the human populations as well. So, you know, the other finding that we've made with the birds is that infertility rates are very high, especially among male birds.
Really?
They're just not as reproductively capable for a number of reasons.
Are their sperm deformed? Is that what it is?
We found dramatically elevated rates of deformed sperm, as well as a condition known as aspermia, where they're actually not producing any sperm at all. Or, and quite a number of them, the sperm they produce are just dead. They don't move and are incapable of doing their job. And so, again, similar sorts of patterns have been reported for the human populations, but they've been written off as being the result of psychological factors.
This makes me so angry, Tim. You know, in medicine, classically, and people don't like us experimenting on animals, but classically, we've derived much of the information we need for medicine from animal experiments, particularly using drugs to see what they do to animals, but all sorts of other things. That's classic, number one. Number two, for people to say that it's because of smoking and high stress levels and immunosuppression, and yet you've got a population that has been heavily exposed to radioactive materials. And in Russia, you know, everyone smokes like crazy. They smoke like chimneys on the whole. They drink like crazy. And yet this population specifically has shown these abnormalities that we've been talking about. So they're not just apologists, these people who are denying scientific reality, but what would you call them? I mean, shills for the nuclear industry. I don't know, but as a physician and a scientist, and I'm sure you probably feel the same way but wouldn't express it the way I do, it makes me extremely annoyed.
Well, you know, it conservatively speaking, I would say that it's time. A lot of new information has arrived in the past 5 or 6 years.
Yeah.
And all of it points to there being some significant component of the morbidities that we observe in the human population.
That's illnesses.
Related to the illnesses that we see being related to the contaminants. And so let's just step back and reevaluate and do a little more research on this.
Yes.
To reanalyze our position.
Yeah. Well, you're doing the pioneering work, absolutely. Now, you've also, Tim Rousseau, been studying insects, spiders, and mammals around Chernobyl. What have you been finding amongst those species?
It's funny. We're finding similar patterns.
Yeah.
Very strong dose-dependent effects on both abundance and biodiversity, as well as, that is, the number of species, as well as visible mutations. It's funny, I was in Kyiv in Ukraine in April for the 25th anniversary meetings that were sponsored by the United Nations. And we had a day off, and so we went to Chernobyl to collect some pollen from some of the plants. And we noticed that there was a bug that was emerging in fairly large numbers at about that time on that day. Small red bug, known as a fire bug, quite common in that part of the world. And they tend to come out in large numbers. If you find one, you tend to find hundreds. And we were in Pripyat, you know, this town next to the reactor.
Oh, I do know the town Pripyat, yes.
And we were collecting some pollen from some annual flowers, because pollen also seemed to be quite sensitive to the contaminants. But anyway, we looked down, and there's this bug, and this bug was missing a spot on its back. These bugs have a red back with black spots and sort of an interesting design. And
the reverse of a ladybird.
Sort of, exactly. And anyway, this one bug was missing one of the spots, and Anders, my colleague, looked down and pointed this out and said, look, there's a mutant bug. And we didn't pay much attention to it until we went to the next spot, which was more contaminated.
Mm-hmm.
We looked down and saw there were 10 bugs out of about 50 that were deformed or had, you know, strange color patterns. Clearly, very indicative of the background contamination level. And during the rest of the day, every spot we went to, we took a radiation level and also counted the frequency of these mutant bugs. Perfect relationship. And so the point of the story being that every time we look at a new system, a new species, we find a very strong signal of this radioactive contaminant.
Oh, my God, that's really scary, isn't
it? It certainly is. It certainly is.
Really scary. So now, I've got another question. Tim, what do you eat when you're there?
Well, you know, we eat what is provided, and we buy a lot of breakfast and lunch materials from the supermarket south of the Chernobyl zone, and which is the food stuff comes from southern Ukraine for the most part, and is relatively clean. But yeah, there's always the danger that some of the food you're going to get will have some, you know, level of contamination. You know, a large part of the country has, this low level of contamination, 5-10 times natural background levels, and there's just no way to avoid it.
What, in the air, in the water, in the food?
In everything.
It concentrates in the food, doesn't it?
Well, it concentrates in some food, but not all. You know, the berries tend to concentrate some of it.
Mushrooms.
Mushrooms are the worst. Yeah. We do avoid eating all forms of mushrooms.
I'm sure. Milk.
Luckily, you know, the main concern are the hot particles of plutonium that are in the ground, in the dust, around the reactor area.
You can inhale. Do you wear a mask?
We do wear masks when we're in the most contaminated.
Good.
But it's not clear to me that they really provide that much.
No. What about the Red Forest?
The same in the Red Forest.
Tell people what the Red Forest is.
The Red Forest, so before the explosion and meltdown, there was the area around the power plant was mostly surrounded by stands of mature Gott's pine forest, these beautiful tall pine trees that shed their bark. You know, they're very attractive. Anyway, when the plant blew up and released all of these contaminants, the forest downwind for many miles of the plant was basically killed overnight.
And
these pine trees went from green to red in a very short period of time.
Dead.
The needles all died. Yeah, hence the name Red Forest.
And it's very contaminated. Now, let's move on, Tim, to the work, the pioneering work, really. And I doff my cap to you and your colleagues, the pioneering work that you've been doing around Chernobyl for quite a number of years now to what is happening at Fukushima.
Yeah, we're hoping to get over there sometime this summer to get some baseline data. I'm a little bit worried, though. I think
you should be. It's bloody, yeah. I mean, really, really contaminated. And gradually the data is leaking out, you know, as is the radiation. And the levels that now they're measuring are higher than those around the exclusion zones in Chernobyl.
Yeah, the question is how much of that material is volatile and hence will dissipate relatively quickly.
Yeah.
Into the atmosphere, and how much of it's been, you know, really deposited and will be staying around for some time to come. The other thing we don't know much about are the number of different isotopes. They've talked a lot about the iodine-131 that's been released and the cesium-137, but I haven't seen a single report on the strontium-90 levels. We're just recently been beginning to hear about the hot particles of uranium and plutonium that were released that nobody really paid much attention to begin with. And there was a report today someplace on tellurium-244 and americium-241 levels
And curium.
And curium,
144, yes, which apparently is just absolutely lethal.
244, yeah.
244, apparently. Yeah.
Yeah, so, again, it's not very unfortunate, but there's definitely been an absence of information. But irrespective of that, it's very clear from the gamma spectroscopy, the basically the surveys of cesium-137 that's been deposited, that vast areas have been heavily contaminated, and of course a much larger amount went into the ocean, and that's new territory for all of us. There really hasn't been much in the way of any kind of study of marine life responses to these kinds of contaminants.
Let alone the groundwater, yeah. Too. The groundwater is heavily contaminated, and that underlies large areas of Japan, and it's also seeping up into sewage systems. And I think that, the response was delayed. Why on earth the Japanese didn't invite in the international community who understands radiation, like the International Atomic Energy Agency and UNESCO and WHO and the Nuclear Regulatory Commission from America. I think they were trying to save face, to cover up, to hide. They haven't had the sort of international support that they could have had, like people at Chernobyl got, number one. And number two, I don't think they've been really measuring very adequately the levels of radiation in lots of places and the sort of isotopes or radioactive elements that have been escaping. I mean, I think the measurements have been leave much to be desired.
Yeah, I don't know what has been done. I do know that the U.S. Department of Energy and the NNSA did send...
National Nuclear Safety Agency, yeah.
Right.
Right.
They were there on the ground from the beginning, as far as I know.
Yeah.
And some of the best maps that we've seen have been generated by those groups.
Which groups, again, were they? The NNSA and...
The NNSA and the Department of Energy.
U.S. government, right.
Yeah, and so some of the reports that have come out recently showing these very, relatively detailed maps of contaminants have come from that group, and that's where we're getting the best information.
Right, but yeah, so we should go to their websites. But then I read today or yesterday, Japanese government are going to make the children at kindergarten wear radiation badges to measure the levels of radiation to which they're being exposed, Tim.
Yeah, if that were useful, that would be, great. But of course, if they're getting most of their dose from ingestion in the food and the water, then
that's
those
right.
Radiation badges are kind of useless.
Useless.
I think there has to be more attention paid to measuring the radionuclide levels in the food and the water and the air.
Yeah, the other thing is, of course, that accident hasn't ended. And, if there's another major earthquake, in fact, we just experienced in New Zealand yesterday some major aftershocks at a place called Christchurch, a town that has been devastated by two massive earthquakes 3 months apart. And then yesterday there were more earthquakes. Well, they call them aftershocks, but that could also occur at Fukushima. And if that happens, Building 4, which is tipping at a rather precarious level, and the buildings have been made very vulnerable to damage because of the hundreds of thousands of tons of water that have been poured into them. And water, of course, is very heavy. So structurally, they're weakened. And Building 4 has a huge amount of radioactive material in the cooling pool on its roof. And if that goes, well, God help everyone, because then much of that material will be released. Or if there have been three melt-throughs, melt-through means melting through the containment vessel onto the concrete floor, and there could be a massive hydrogen explosion. And now the weather has changed. The winds are now blowing south over Japan instead of from west to east. And the rainy season is occurring. And, you know, if there is another major release of radiation, Tim, that, would you like to comment?
I think the situation is very unstable, and the worst is it's not over yet, as you say. There's a lot of work left done.
Yeah. You know, I want to say that Dr. Musso has been appointed to the National Academy of Sciences Committee on Radiation. Would you like to talk about that, Tim? What specific committee are you on, and what work is this committee doing?
I can't say too much because we're just in the beginning stages. The U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission has commissioned the National Academy of Sciences to develop a plan to investigate any relationships between cancer in human populations and nuclear power plants. And so there's a new panel that's actually at the moment developing the protocols, as it were, for this study, which will occur in the coming years. Very exciting group of questions that have to be addressed. A super bunch of scientists involved in developing this plan, and I'm very honored to be included in the group. Hopefully we'll come up with a program of study that will allow us to address this question with sufficient rigor to be conclusive.
Yeah, it's a very, very timely, very important committee, and I really congratulate you, Tim Musso, for being on it. Look, Tim, I know that you are absolutely exhausted with jet lag. You've just got back from Russia and the Ukraine, and you need to go to bed. You've given us a fabulous interview. I've pushed you a bit hard, I'm sorry, but the sort of work you're doing now couldn't be more vital for the world, really, to understand the biological ramifications of these nuclear accidents and what nuclear power really means. So I really congratulate you, Dr. Musso, on the work that you're doing, and we'll all be indebted to you in time.
You're very kind. Thank you, Helen.
Yeah. Thanks, Tim. My guest today on If You Love This Planet was Dr. Timothy Musso, a professor of biological sciences at the University of South Carolina and one of the leading world authorities concerning the impacts of low-dose radiation on natural ecosystems. You're listening to If You Love This Planet. Now you'll hear an excerpt from a speech I gave at the International Physicians for the Prevention of Nuclear War Congress in Berlin on the 25th anniversary of Chernobyl in April 2011. I'm also dedicating this lecture to my friend and sister, Petra Kelly. Petra and I worked almost hand in hand. She did Europe and I did the United States during the 1980s when the threat of nuclear war was impending, when Ronald Reagan said over an open microphone, I've pressed the button, the missile, I'm paraphrasing, missiles have been launched. I met with Reagan in the White House for an hour and a quarter. I established quickly a doctor-patient relationship with him. I held his hand for at least half that time. He knew nothing about nuclear weapons or delivery systems or CIA reports. I just finished my book, Missile Envy, and so I would correct him. He would then get a malar flush, become very anxious, so I had to hold his hand to reassure him. I estimated his IQ to be average 100, but I also came out of the meeting saying I thought he had impending Alzheimer's disease, which indeed he did. He was the commander-in-chief in charge of thousands of hydrogen bombs with a three-minute decision time whether or not to launch. This is a very sad time in the history of the world. I have often imagined a major nuclear meltdown and have said for many years that that will end the nuclear industry. I never imagined four reactors having various stages of meltdowns built on an earthquake fault by a very capable people, the Japanese, and the fuel pools melting as well. I never imagined it. When I first heard about it 4 weeks ago, being a physician, I extrapolated the prognosis. If indeed one or more of those reactors break through the containment and we have another Chernobyl or two Chernobyls, that will mean millions of cases of cancer in the Northern Hemisphere. How hard do we work to try and save a child's life who's dying of leukemia or Wilms tumour? How hard do we work to try and save a woman's life who's dying of metastatic breast cancer? The medical dictum says if we have an incurable disease, the only way and recourse is prevention. The nuclear industry was begun. Well, I've got a fascinating book here. It's called Radioactive. It's about Madame Curie and Pierre Curie. And it's relevant, I think. When they first discovered X-rays, electricity, radio, the telegraph, the X-rays and radioactivity, at the turn of the 20th century, a series of invisible forces were radically transforming daily life. The advances were dazzling. For some time, they blurred the boundary between science and magic. If invisible light could pass through flesh and expose the human skeleton, was it so fantastical to believe in levitation, in telekinesis, in communicating with the dead? And this began a whole spiritualist movement in the mid-19th century, which seduced millions who were promising contact with the divine through ghosts and spirits. So we've always been fascinated with radiation, as was Madame Curie and Pierre Curie. They gave birth to death. Madame Curie died of aplastic anemia induced by radium. Pierre Curie, he was run over by a horse and buggy. Her daughter, she died of leukemia too. We have known since the beginning of the nuclear age that that radiation induces cancer. However, we're in the middle of a huge argument. The problem is the nuclear physicists since the dawn of the nuclear age, and I knew many of them, they were my friends. George Kistiakowsky, who supplied the implosion mechanism for the first A-bomb. Vicky Wyskoff, Philip Morrison, Edward Teller, who I debated, and I beat him. Jerry Wiesner, who was Jack Kennedy's science advisor. Ted Taylor, who developed the suitcase hydrogen bomb. I knew them all. They were racked with guilt because they had helped to vaporise and kill over 200,000 people in a flash of light in Hiroshima and Nagasaki. They thought if they could harness atoms for peace, then they could go to their graves relatively not guilty. They all went to their graves guilty. They knew right from the beginning the toxicity of plutonium. In fact, Glenn Seaborg, who developed plutonium-239, spoke about it at the beginning. Plutonium is so toxic that when injected into beagle dogs, there wasn't a dose low enough that didn't give every dog cancer, 10 to the minus 9 grams. It said that a microgram is definitely carcinogenic, but it may be much lower. Each reactor manufactures 250 kilos of plutonium per year. It's only needed 2.5 kilos to make yourself an atomic bomb. The half-life of plutonium is 24,400 years. It lasts for 250,000 years or more. It is handled like iron by the body. It's an iron analog. If inhaled, it induces lung cancer. And let me just point out that the nuclear industry is lying. It lies continuously. It talks about permissible doses of radiation. As we all know as physicians, there is no permissible dose of radiation. As we know as physicians, it is background radiation that induced evolution. Advantageous genes survived. Fish developed lungs. Birds developed wings. We, this magnificent species with a huge neocortex, opposing thumbs, standing on our hind legs, evolved. I happen to think we're an evolutionary aberrant. But most mutations are deleterious and induce disease. As we know, we all carry several hundred genes for disease, cystic fibrosis, diabetes, phenylketonuria, inborn errors of metabolism, dwarfism. There are now 2,600 genetic diseases described. Most are recessive. And yet George Monbiot, in his wisdom, accrued over 3 days reading some scientific and medical literature, said that surprisingly no genetic abnormalities were seen in the offspring of the Hibakusha at Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Why not? Because either they were fatal mutations, there were many spontaneous abortions, many children have been born with gross congenital abnormalities, which are almost certainly teratogenic. And this is described in this wonderful book put together by Yablokov, and I can't wait to hear him speak later on, and Nestorenko, two Nestorenkos. Photographs of children with phocomelia, babies were born with anencephaly, cyclops, spina bifida, you name it. There are homes full of children in Belarus and Ukraine, of grossly deformed children. That was an excerpt from a speech I gave in Berlin in April 2011 at the International Physicians for the Prevention of Nuclear War Congress on the 25th anniversary of Chernobyl. Thanks for listening today. This is very important stuff, you know. We all have to understand this, because our very lives and the lives of our children and descendants depend upon it. Thanks for listening this week, and we'll be with you next week. Bye for now.
You've been listening to If You Love This Planet with Dr. Helen Caldicott. This program is broadcast on community radio across the United States, including our host station, KPFT Pacifica, Houston, Texas. This program is produced and engineered by Jazz Williams, co-produced by Scott Powell, and our publicity and outreach are coordinated by Amanda Bellerby. To listen to previous shows or to make a donation, go to our website, ifyoulovethisplanet.org.